You're not alone. You're not alone in that you're a country that's well-connected. Find your peer. If you can't find it in your library, find it in your region. If you can't find your region, find your country. If you can't find your country, you can find it in the world. And librarians are generous of spirit and spending their time. Build your network and make sure that you're not alone. And that the last part of that is, and that I was going to say that you're not crazy, but the truth is find people just as crazy as you are.
Podcast De Bieb is Meer gaat op zoek naar de toekomst van openbare bibliotheken en hoe zij bijdragen aan de maatschappelijke uitdagingen van deze tijd. Met nieuws uit de sector, spraakmakende gasten en verrassende thema's word je meegenomen in de wereld van leesbevordering, digitaal burgerschap en participatie. De Bieb is Meer is een initiatief van Matt Gubbels die jou wil informeren en inspireren. Hij gelooft in de kracht van podcasting en het verhaal van de bibliotheek.
Welcome to this new episode of this podcast and a very special welcome to the listeners outside of the Netherlands. Thank you for tuning in. My name is Matt Gubbels and I've been involved in the field of libraries for quite a few years. Recently, I became acquainted with the ideas and books of our guest of honor. So therefore, I'm delighted to navigate with him into his vision and into his ideas.
My name is Irene Harmsen. And since 2017, I've been involved with the library as a teacher of the training college of community librarians. I've trained with all the thoughts and theory from David Lenkes. I'm very pleased that the training is recognized by the Association of Public Libraries. And the training is also owned by the sector. So I'm very proud to have the opportunity to talk to you in this podcast today.
After a very interactive day with our guest, it's now time to speak more in depth with the man sitting next to us here in the living room. May I ask you to give another warm welcome to David Lenkes. David, so welcome. Thank you very much. You've been in Holland for about 1 week now, and you present your ideas everywhere and talk to people all over the country. How do you keep up with such a busy schedule?
A lot of French fries with mayonnaise and pancakes.
That's a very short answer today. What are your first impressions from your visits in the Netherlands? We know that you have been into the Lokhal last Friday. Can you tell us more?
Yes, I've been fortunate to see sort of amazing public libraries, and I sincerely some of the best public libraries in the world. Lokhal, Utrecht, I've seen Dock here in Delft. Also seen some amazing libraries such as the at the Rijksmuseum, their research library. And my impression is a lot of conversation has gone into these books that we talk about. And so we've been talking about these concepts a lot. And I say we as in myself, but internationally, I mean, talking with Eric Burstein here, talking with people around the world, it's happening. Right? It's not just a theory. It's not just what we could do. We're actually seeing people thoughtfully bring this about. And so walking into all these different settings, it builds my energy to see great community connections.
This morning, you have been guided around into today's venue, Cultura SO, here in Noorddorp. Which of your ideas from the Atlas do you recognize?
Well, let me be clear. I don't claim all of the ideas. Most of my job as an academic is to listen, synthesize, and develop them. But I would say some of the ideas that I certainly put forward is the idea that the community is co-owning the space, that space itself can be shaped by functions instead of saying predetermined, this is where the books are and this is where the children go. Watching and helping to build around it, I think that's essential. I think the role of librarians. I mean, the biggest thing that I learned today was hearing about all the different programs and services that started with a conversation with someone from the community going, I'm interested in this, how I do it. And then that turns into ballet studios, that turns into programming and shapes of books. So that to me is the notion of librarian facilitating knowledge creation co-owned with their community. That's just beautifully what we see here.
In the Atlas, you refer to the situation in North America, the United States of America. Can you reflect on the difference with Europe and what it means here to implement the new librarianship?
Well, I did mention that you put mayonnaise with French fries, but Sorry, it's a cheap joke.
I know.
It really is better. In North America, you have... And actually, this is something I'm thinking about now. So it's not fully thought through, and the Atlas was written, God knows, too many years ago. It's the role that education plays in it. So we're in some of the most innovative public library spaces, and you have no library school. You have no degree, for example. In the United States, we have library degrees, but we don't necessarily have great all... I mean, there's some fantastic libraries, but there's some libraries that even that education doesn't guarantee it's going to happen. So what I'm really thinking about right now is how does one become a librarian? By education, yes, sometimes just by job title, but what's the spirit of it? When they come into the role, how do, you know, I've talked to many people that come from the commercial sector, and they come in and they believe in community connection. They believe in intellectual freedom. They believe in all of these things. Where does that come from? Is it just built into the culture? If it doesn't come from my classroom, where are they getting it? And then am I the problem that in my classroom I'm beating the innovation out of my students? So that's currently what's keeping me up at night.
Many people in the Netherlands, and especially some of the young people here in the audience, see you as a guru in the field of librarianship. And my question is, tell us more about that. Is that really the case, or have we made a guru out of you?
my wife is with me on this trip, and she makes sure that anytime someone calls a guru, that in the evening there will be a debriefing. Will be made very clear that while that may work out there, you still have to do the dishes. I'm honored when people look at my ideas, appreciate my ideas, and find value in my ideas. I think it is a title that needs to be given as opposed to taken. It varies in different places. Some places I'm a guru, and some places I'm an unwanted guest. In some places I'm just telling people what they already know, which makes me happy if they're doing that. And so I guess the title doesn't necessarily mean much to me, but I do love the fact that it gives me the opportunity to meet with really cool people in really cool places. I think that's a responsibility to listen, get stories, and then I tell them to the next group, and we share those stories among the profession.
At the end of our conversation, we will talk more in depth on the academic value of your ideas. But before we do so, I would like you to listen to the following sound clip.
These are the best days of librarianship right now. And this is the time to really take charge. And we're seeing it move forward, and we've got momentum. And librarians will, you know, Librarians for World Domination is happening. Be a part of it.
David, when I heard this last week, and when you last Friday welcomed me to the revolution, I was intrigued. In order to know you a little bit better, how should we look upon you? As an academic, or yet more as an activist?
I don't think those things are exclusive. I think that what a good academic and what a good scholar does is they discover a better way of seeing the world, right? A different way, but hopefully a better way of seeing the world. And then I think that comes with responsibility. That once you know something, once you discover something, it is you're obliged to not only share that information, which is central to scholarship, but also deal with the impact of that. I mean, you know, we can go back to the Oppenheimer movie just came out, and I would love to, you know, I'm glad that none of my research results in atomic explosions, but that idea that you know, through research, through studies, through seeing, through visits, I have seen that when libraries of all types, schools and public and special and all these kinds of things, when they engage the public and when librarians take on the role of that engagement, things get better. And so when you know something, you have to make that happen. Really quickly, there's this concept, this study book coming out in the United States. It's called Deaths of Despair. And what it says is that groups without a lot of socioeconomic status, without a lot of college degrees in the United States, that they are dying at a higher rate than the rest of people with a four-year college degree. When you know that, when you know that they are dying of alcohol-related diseases, when they're dying of drug overdoses, when they're dying of suicide, because they feel socially isolated and because they feel powerless, how can you not be an activist to change that situation? And so when I look at libraries and I look at librarians and the work they do, and a lot of that is simply connecting people, giving them a place to meet and run into people, how can you not be an activist and say, I have to do something. I have to save lives. And I think in librarianship, for a long time, we were so focused on the operations and such that we didn't see the bigger picture, which is we have an opportunity to help people live longer, live better, live in greater status. And so knowing that as a scholar means as a human being, I have to act upon it. So to me, the division between scholar and activist is arbitrary at best.
But now I understand. Thank you. Before we move on to the next topic, I would like to ask the audience, is there anyone who would like to phrase one more question to know David even better than we know him after this long day?
I have a question. You mentioned in the discussion about whether you're not a guru, that you're sometimes an unwanted guest as well. And I'm just very curious, what criticism do you get and who gives you that criticism?
I won't mention names.
No names.
The criticisms that I get is that I often de-emphasize some fundamental parts of librarianship. And by doing that, I think people feel that that is the equivalent of ignoring them or disregarding them. As an example, in the Atlas, elsewise, I spend a lot of time talking about programs and people and connections. I don't spend a lot of time talking about collection management, talking about classification, talking about information organization. Some people take that to say I don't believe it's important or necessary, when oftentimes what I'm trying to say is that's an important core skill. How do we use it and manipulate it and change it? So that's one. One is you're not paying enough attention to our history, to some of these core skills. And oftentimes I don't disagree that I de-emphasize them, not because they're unimportant, but because I don't think I can add much to that conversation. The other is a series of things, normally in the sense of, I've always said librarians never say no, they simply tell you why it wouldn't work here, right? Oh, that's a great idea, that's wonderful, we can't do that. But someone else could. And so that's often like, well, we hear this idea about connecting to communities, and we hear the idea of co-ownership, and I'm sure that works really great in, fill in the slot, a public library, not an academic library. A small library, not a big library. A big library, not a small library. And so sometimes that's what you hear. Those are the major criticisms, which is just, and it's not that we disagree necessarily, it's that emphasis. The one part where I think there is a serious disagreement, which is that activism component. Because I am calling on librarians to shape communities and have power within communities, as opposed to being neutral, as opposed to being civil servants, as opposed to looking at themselves as a service and not as change. And that's where I think we sometimes run into some serious disagreements about, you know, librarians should be civil servants that serve the people. They'll be told what their job is. They're not to have an opinion. They're not to talk about politics, God forbid. And I say back, we're in the knowledge business and how a community knows itself. How is that not how it governs itself?
Thank you.
Well, David, we've seen your books here on the little table. It's a field guide and the atlas. I heard a lot of people saying, well, I didn't read. So maybe they are here in the audience. But yesterday I was talking to my students and even they told me, well, we didn't read the books. But sometimes we also found it very difficult. Are you preparing for a new book?
as a slight aside, the field guide, the original title of the Field Guide of New Librarianship was The Radical's Guide to New Librarianship. And then I ran into some honest-to-God radicals who showed me that I was not there. So the name changed. I think my favorite review of the Atlas ever was that my book was the Finnegan's Wake of librarianship, that it can be a lot. And it is. It's flow of consciousness. Cory Doctorow, sort of futurist technologist, pissed me off by putting a review up on Amazon that more or less said, everyone told me I should read this book, but it's not good. The illustrations look like Windows 95, and information should be hierarchically organized. And I was like, that's not the point. And so, no, the Atlas itself is meant as a thought piece. It's me trying to work out the answer to the question of what is a librarian. And it continues to evolve. The field guide was intended to be a textbook. It was intended to be much more linear in its presentation. And I'm currently working on a revised edition of the Atlas. And I ran across the community chapter. And I was like, oh, this does not make sense. Let's rewrite this one. So there's a whole new map, for example. I noticed that if you look at the map that comes with the Atlas, very large map, that's a concept graph of how I see the field. That's not a great tool to say how you should teach the field. And so the whole new map looks radically different with, and God forbid, it has community members on there and not just librarians. So yeah. I take that criticism because it is a difficult book, because it represents working through a difficult concept. And the goal with the field guide, the goal with another book called Expect More, showing up here and talking to people in classes, is we continue to progress, and part of that progressing is making it more accessible.
Yeah, so you don't blame us.
Try harder.
Try harder.
Oh. No, I've been trying to read, was it The Nature of Scientific Revolutions by Kuhn? I've been trying to read that book for 20 years, and I make it to like the third chapter, and I'm just like, my head hurts, and I try again. There are books like that, and that's fine. I don't mind that. I hope it starts a conversation. And if the conversation is, did you try and read that? Yeah, I did. But you know, at least it's a conversation that started.
All right. Well, for our next question, we ask again to listen to a short sound clip.
Uh-oh.
Here you come again.
The major population center of Georgetown, Texas, or demographic, are retirees because it is a large retirement community. Their services, how they lay them out, what they do at a distance, what kind of programming are all driven around serving this different population. That needs expertise. In other words, the shaping requires specialties, requires experience, requires principles, requires instruction. To me, makes the role of the librarian and the professional librarian even more vital now.
Well, this clip is about competences. Mm-hmm. What type of expertise do you think librarians need? Can you tell us a little bit more? And, well, you've said already a lot about what we should do today, but let's look at the expertises.
Yeah. So there are three components that make up a librarian to me. One is the mission, mm-hmm. to improve society through basically helping people learn. One is the means by which we do that, and then one is the values. So if you talk about competencies, the competencies break down into, first and foremost, how we understand knowledge, which sounds very abstract, but I if you look at knowledge as something that can be recorded and put on books, that's a one set of competencies. If you look at competencies as uniquely human, learning suddenly becomes a fundamental. How do people learn? Pedagogy, andragogy becomes a competency. Then you look at those means. How do we provide access? That gets into classification of materials and books and materials, but it also gets into technology, creating social spaces, working on the web, creating different functional areas to lay out design. When you talk about knowledge, we talk about pedagogy, learning, understanding how people learn. Then you talk about the environment, so that's design, physical design, and also programmatic design. How do we make it welcoming spaces? Peter Cook of the Tilburg says the three things you need for a successful library is the best coffee in town, the cheapest, easiest to access Wi-Fi, and as many plugs as you can put in, right? So that's something that people can learn. And then finally, motivation, understanding what drives people to reach out and connect. And then the values are knowing things like, when we talk about intellectual freedom, what does that mean? So to me, those become very specific competencies, some of them from traditional areas such as information organization, cataloging, information seeking, and some of them from other areas such as education and pedagogy, and something very unique to the profession, which is, why do we have these values? Why is it that we fight censorship? Why is it that we believe in diversity? Why is it that we bring those? So those, to me, are really specific competencies that we can integrate into a curriculum and preparation.
I think though some of them are really in it, but I think it can be more specific as
yes.
well.
Yes, oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, absolutely.
If yeah. you would like to spend the next 3 hours diagramming out the competencies, we can have that moment. But yeah.
Oh, yeah. Just
the,
okay.
Hit the high points.
That. Yeah. Well, to what extent do you believe that all librarians should have higher vocational or university education?
Ouch. Mm. Librarians, three ways to become a librarian, I believe. So the first is librarian by credential. And I believe that higher education in general, higher education in the United States in particular, is in major need of reform. We require people to leave an environment to learn about an environment. We require a lot of investment of money in the United States, at least, to be owing to a service profession. So I think I believe in library credentials. I'm part of that, but I believe we need to be part of reforming that. I love the idea, for example, of in the medical field, we have teaching hospitals. If you're going to be a doctor, you, as a student, go into a hospital, you go on rounds, you treat people. I love the idea of a teaching library where people spend part of their time in a library doing service as part of that learning. The other way is through job title. Congratulations, you're a librarian. In the Netherlands, I've seen people with very high-level profession experiences, consultants and IT experts and museum curators come and become library directors. We have other situations, for example, in my home country, we have plenty of people without even college degrees becoming librarians because they're clerks. And that's what that's how that community is used to seeing the library. And so I wonder, how do we make sure that we open up opportunities through online distance education, through modules and courses, through continued development, not just of the skills, but of these larger competencies, larger values? How can I help a lone librarian without a college degree in the middle of rural Nebraska stand up to the mayor and say, we will not ban these books because libraries don't ban those books? Getting someone to that sense of validity where they feel like I'm important enough and this is my job to say, I'm sorry, that's not what librarians do. How do we get to that point? The last way to become a librarian is through spirit, though Eric convinced me it's by heart. It's those who believe in the value, believe in the power that these museum curators are coming over, and I think what we need to do is prepare a welcoming environment. If Bill Gates wants to give a lot of money because he believes in the mission of libraries, let's call him a librarian. It's okay. And I'm not saying he's buying his way in, but I can be bought. How do we reach out to the people who truly believe and share our values and say, you're one of us? You know, whether it's an elected member of the European Parliament, whether it's an elected member, whether it's a singer, whether it's an actor, we need to invite in people that what I call our peer aspirants, the people that we really wish were our peers. Let's invite them in and make them feel welcome. We had a wonderful dinner with a world-famous architect last night. I want her to feel like she's welcome in the library sphere because she helps us get better and we can help her design better.
Perfect. Wow. For our next question and subjects, we're going to watch another clip.
Okay.
We need to knit together the community that talks about how we share and seek power. How can we work together to guarantee a better tomorrow for all? That's the promise of librarianship. It has never been about collecting things. It has been about collecting ideas to empower a community.
Yes. Librarians spend a lot of time doing things that are not very interesting. Yeah. There's a lot of jobs on cleaning bathrooms and putting away books and making sure the doors open and helping people make a copy for the third time. And oftentimes when we get so involved in those daily tasks, we forget that our core mission, what we're seeking to do, is to help a whole society know itself better. And that sounds really lofty, but that's what we do, right? We save lives. We help make meaning. We come in the footsteps of the people who preserved society during the medieval period. We come in the footsteps of those that pushed science forward out of the Iberian Peninsula in Muslim Spain, as libraries weren't open and were creating new architecture, new mathematics out of India. And when all of that information flooded up into Italy, it was so powerful what these libraries did, it forced a renaissance that totally transformed Western civilization. That's our heritage. And I know it's hard to remember that heritage when there's a bathroom problem and when someone has a tax question. But that's where it starts. I mean, you know, it's a bit of a, not sure how true it is, but Einstein figuring out relativity because he was trying to get the clocks to run properly on the train lines. Something that starts small, helping one person that you didn't know you were going to help before, giving a little bit of service, can lead to a massive, unimaginably positive impact. And so even though we might deal with the day-to-day, and that might be boring, we are of a tradition. And what time in history, excuse me a moment, where we've had a pandemic, a new land war in Europe, where we have a Middle Eastern crisis, where we have right-wing governments against left-wing governments, against digital transformation, the rise of artificial intelligence. Tell me another time in history when society needs guidance and knowledge building in an ethical way. What time in history desperately needs librarians to help make sense?
Well, I totally agree what you say, but...
But, yeah, it's always a but.
But, there's always a but. I've heard, even today, saying people, I work in a library now for a year or two, and it's still not very clear what I'm doing here. Mm-hmm. So they get all kind of tasks to do. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if they just clean the toilets as well, but mm-hmm. it could be. What do we need in library? It's not only the librarian who is on their mission, but we also need people who take leadership into it, because working in a library is working in a community, and you also need some guidance, and you can't just ask from librarian to guide on their own. So I think we should also go on a mission to the directors of libraries. What do you think?
Yes. And the community, right? I mean, mm-hmm. So let me be really clear, because I think I've actually used now the phrase of world domination through librarianship. You asked about people who are not happy that I'm there. I had a really interesting conversation. In one Twitter feed, I was called both a communist and a Nazi. I mean, I don't know how that happens, but I mean, it was like images of jackbooted librarians marching through the street, forcing people to read at their reading level. I don't know. So the community is first and foremost vital. We are working with, shaping, part of, we belong to that community. Leadership is vitally important. Changing from the, you know, if what we do is we take the newest person with the least political connections and social connections with an organization and say, here, you're in charge of the community, that's insanity. It's not going to work. No. So you need to have, from the top to the bottom, people who believe that the library can reshape itself to a community, yeah. and that they co-own that process with the community to do it. So yes, leadership is vital.
Vital. Well, we go back to the audience then.
Truly inspiring. And what I also read in the field guide was this systems of systems. Yeah. In which you have multiple systems and where people can navigate. How does this function within what we just discussed?
So I'm going to reference a good, brilliant colleague of mine, Marie Ostergaard. Marie is the director of the Aarhus Public Library in Denmark, and she has this most elegant concept, which I try and repeat as often as I can. And she talks about the library as a movement. And the notion is that the library is a place, it's a collection, it's a function, it's a budget, but that the librarians are almost separate. That the librarians are users of the library. It's the only time I let people use that phrase. and they stand side by side with the community. So the library becomes a platform, which is a technical definition of a system of a systems is a platform. So it's a platform, it's a tool set that librarians hand in hand with the community can go in and say, oh, we need to meet. All right, we have a place to meet. Oh, we need materials. All right, we have a place for materials. Oh, we need technology. We have that. So this and grabbing that, using that system of systems, that platform, to then identify, all right, the community wants to be more literate, more economically vital, wants to be more whatever, and it is that movement that allows it to happen. So library's platform, library as movement, all comes around this concept that we have different systems, technology systems, people systems, book systems, but they all work in coordination towards social progress.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
There's another question.
Lady over there has a question.
Could you or would you go back to the floor yourself, and in what kind of community area would you want to work?
So my experience in libraries, I have a master's in telecommunications and a PhD in information science. But I ran a government information center around education. That's my floor experience. And it was, I started working in the system in 1992, which may be a number that doesn't mean much to people, but 1993 is when the web was released. And it was a time that we had to migrate, this service that I was part of and eventually ran, we migrated from getting in physical items, microfiching them, building, indexing and abstracting them and building a thesauri to do it. I mean, if you want to know my background in libraries, look at the most quintessential librarianship thing. That's what we did. And it was interesting because the goal was always to improve education. Teachers, policymakers were going to do better things with schools. And when we saw the internet originally with the email, and I have to give a huge shout out to Mike Eisenberg, who saw this vision. We called it Ask Eric, and it was an Eric clearinghouse. He said, what if we just let teachers ask us questions? We have email now, and eventually it turned into the web, Gopher, if you remember those things. What does it look like when you do that? And what does it do when suddenly you don't just have, well, I'm an expert, I'm looking at some materials, I'm going to pick them, but now we got 20 questions on this. That must be a hot topic. We have 300 questions on this. Let's build a resource. They need lesson plans. And it allowed us to be responsive. And the library that we built wasn't physical, but it was the first websites. We built one of the first 100 websites and et cetera. And I tell you, those were the best days of my life. Now as my wife is listening, now are the best days of my life, dear. But professionally, that inventiveness, the invigoration, I was working with librarians and students and all sorts of people just going, hey, why not? This is what it is today. That was a fascinating time to work in. So I don't know if that answered your question, but thank you for letting me spend a little moment on memories.
David, let's go a little bit deeper into your atlas and the academic foundations of the atlas. Can you tell us more about that?
The background is that it technically grows from a series of qualitative methods in the sense of their elite interviews, which is a way of saying I went and talked to a lot of really smart people doing really smart things, and to begin to synthesize and identify, right? So what was happening is you had Delft and then a few other libraries that were really starting to do different things, talking with them, expressing, and then combining it with theory, which in this case is something called conversation theory. And conversation theory is a theory of learning, not a theory of librarianship, but a theory of learning. And the reason that using conversation theory as a way of structuring it is that libraries are artificial things. We create them. Having a theory of libraries is like having a theory of Tesla. I mean, first of all, good luck, right? It's shaped and created by other forces, right? Mm-hmm. So we look at organizational force, et cetera. So when we looked at libraries, the question started in social media, why are we doing this? What are people doing online with social media? Are they collecting friends? Is it a collection development effort? Is it reference where they're answering questions? And the answer was shut up and listen. They were learning. And so conversation theory was the strong theory that built it in. We then built case study. I say we because, yes, I'm the author on it, but I've worked with Todd Marshall and brilliant doctoral students and such throughout this process, Eric Borkstein. My job was to put into words to explain what was happening organically. And like I mentioned, South Korea has some brilliant libraries. They've never read my book, but I could walk in and say, this is exactly how I would have envisioned it. And so because it comes from this deep understanding that library is about learning and knowledge, not about things and stuff, the things and stuff help us do the former. And so so academically, if you want to talk it, it's complexity theory with a little dash of conversation theory and some qualitative methodologies on top.
Can you say that learning theory is also one of your foundations?
Well, conversation theory is an early dialectical theory. It has certainly been updated since. So you talk about metacognition, you talk about dialectic theories and learning theories. There's a strong, strong sense of constructivism and constructionism that fit in there in Seymour Papert's work. So yes, it's when I look at librarianship, to me, there are theories of organization which are interesting, but to me, it's fundamentally about knowledge, which means it's fundamentally about learning and learning theory. Yes.
Yeah. Knowledge is a very difficult thing in these days, and especially the way knowledge is created. Therefore, I would like you to listen to another clip.
Librarians can lead the way. We can be helping to prepare society, prepare our communities, and utilize technology in a positive way. We can dominate ethical AI. We can become part of shaping this technology to ensure what is best for our communities, not what is best for the people who have enough power. We need to host this technology. We need to shape this technology. We need to educate on this technology and educate that technology.
You take an extremely positive view on the current developments around artificial intelligence and how it affects knowledge and the way it's created. Aren't you actually saying that librarians should embrace AI?
Librarians should embrace AI. But let me be really clear. Librarians should embrace and shape AI. Right now, I take a positive view of AI. I do. I think there are lots of issues. I think we've overreached in what we think AI can be. And once again, we're talking about generative AI. When we talk about AI, my watch is AI. I drive a car that's driven by AI. My son was applying to jobs reviewed by AI. AI's here. Done. I think we can be a strong force in shaping it. What I worry about, there's a movement around public AI. How do we build a public AI infrastructure? And they're talking to libraries. And the conversations, and they're doing it again. The conversations are, libraries have a lot of data. We can consume that data and turn it into generative models. And I said, yeah. Libraries also have these things called librarians, which can help you try not to do stupid things like Google did 2 weeks ago when all of their answers came with things like, sure, you can smoke 3 cigarettes a day when you're pregnant. And, running with scissors is excellent cardiovascular workouts. And you should eat little rocks every day to get your minerals, right? Google tried to move from the pointing to answers to creating answers and discovered librarianship. They didn't know that's what they were discovering, but they discovered that when you seek to synthesize and provide answers, that's what librarians have been trying to figure out for hundreds of years. And we haven't gotten it right yet, but we're smarter in terms of how we do that. And so they need us, and we need them to need us. Because if they continue to develop the way they are, we're going to end up with AI systems, which frankly aren't that useful, but have great impact. Knowledge, I would argue, is actually easy to create. We create it all the time. The question is, and I'm not in any way convinced that that's what AI is generating, but AI can facilitate it. We're in a story house of the Netherlands, the Dutch story house. AI can help explode stories. People can come in. I don't know how to draw. No problem. Can you describe what you want? I don't know how to write. Here, can you write and it will help you clarify it? I can't read Dutch. No problem. AI helps us tell those stories. But it's still our stories that matter. So, yeah, I'm optimistic. I think we've overpromised. But I think that librarians have a strong role to play in how it evolves now.
I think that's another subject for the training, to take more information of how we can use or work it out into our work as librarians as well.
100%. Yeah. I think, when we talk about organizing information, generating answers, AI is now part of it. We've done several studies, and we found, for example, that when students get answers from librarians and from AI, they prefer both because they do different things. They don't trust the AI, they trust the librarian, but the AI gives them really specific evidence or materials, and the librarian tends to give them more general things, and it fits well together. So we're increasingly talking about AI as augmented intelligence, that is, AI and humans working together in their functions.
We're here now in the Netherlands with 133 libraries, and we are making a network agenda. What do you suggest there should be in it, in these agenda for the future?
Wow. I think we need to recognize when we talk about networks and systems that we're changing from very common libraries sharing functions to very diverse libraries sharing people and ideas. That is, you know, a lot of networks that we built where we will teach you how to catalog or we will support digitization because everyone does it. We will build standards that say this much square footage, this kind of service, this kind of thing. We're very prescriptive in what a library should be, and our networks, therefore, were how we get economies of scale by combining functions or shifting. Now, Tilburg looks different from Utrecht, looks different from Delft, looks different, right? Yeah. And so now, particularly since we don't have a library science education program, what we need to do on a regular basis is, oh, what did you learn yesterday in Tilburg? What did you learn yesterday in Utrecht? How do we share that and have conversations on a regular basis so that our standards are, librarians should have these skills. These skills tend to be around people interactions. And so that network helps support those individual libraries, particularly if there's two librarians or three librarians in an area where they can feel like they have the advice of the entire country and the backing of the entire country when they need it. So I think it's shifting from shared functions to preparing and connecting people.
I love to work that out, yeah. I just asked you a few minutes ago about your new book. Mm. Is that a nice idea for a new book, or...
I have lots of ideas for books. This notebook is my current. I want to do the Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, but the library version. I'm thinking of dragging my son on trains all around Europe where we just sort of stop at libraries and go, so how's it going? And write that up and have philosophical discussions. Yeah. He would not enjoy that. So I have lots of ideas. But I have to say, seeing what you've talked about in reality, and I don't want to take credit for it, but I have an interest in seeing these ideas implemented because whoever they come from, they're good ideas. This has been really satisfying to see these ideas. It's also a point where you can say, well, done. It's like, you guys got it. Take it from here. I'm going to move on to, I don't know, investigating the information use of very rich people who like flying academics around the world. but instead, I'm more motivated than ever to say, all right, how can I help you? How can I help you? How can I help you? Right? So if a bearded, bow-tied American professor can show up and be of use, great. Or don't show up and be of use, great. Right? How can I help you? And by the way, as a bow tie, I have to be careful because I know we're done. It's essential that if you're a bow tie wearer, by the end of any event, you have to untie it to demonstrate that it's not a clip-on.
Oh, we love that. We love that. We used to know someone who did that as well, remember? Yeah. Well, we're closing right now, and it was a long day, a lot of talking. Did you have a good time here today?
Oh, I had a fabulous time. You guys are awesome.
Oh, good. And, well, is there any last suggestion just for us here to take, sort of take-home message for us?
You're not alone.
Yes. Oh, wow.
In the Disney sense, you've got a friend in me, but you're not alone in that you're a country that's well-connected. Find your peer. If you can't find it in your library, find it in your region. If you can't find your region, find your country. If you can't find your country, you can find it in the world. And librarians are generous of spirit and spending their time. Build your network and make sure that you're not alone. And that the last part of that is, and that I was going to say that you're not crazy, but the truth is find people just as crazy as you are. So there you go.
Thank you.
David, thank you very much. We had a great day with you here in Nootdorp. And yeah, I believe in you. because I believe in change, I believe in society, I believe in solving that.
Yeah.
And that idea I like. So I want to thank you, and please give another applause for the great David Lankers.
Bedankt voor het luisteren naar deze aflevering van De Biep is Meer. Heb je zelf een mooi verhaal om te vertellen? Neem dan contact op via info@onderzoekmeteffect.nl. De Biep is Meer is een initiatief van Matt Gubbels. Hij gelooft in de kracht van podcasting en het verhaal van de bibliotheek. Graag tot een volgende keer.